The Y Curve with Phil Dobby and Roger Hearing.
There's a political earthquake coming.
The election here could see the Conservatives reduced to under 100 seats.
And much of that will be down to a party that probably won't win any.
Reform is the latest version of the Brexit Party, formerly UKIP, and it's likely to draw away a lot of Tory support.
It's a party of a new kind. A populist party.
And populist movements are on the march around the world, in Europe, Brazil, the Philippines and the USA, upsetting the old notions of left and right.
So what is populism?
And how will it change global politics?
The why.
So here's the interesting thing. The latest polls from Politico, their poll of polls.
Yes, yes.
So they got Labour on 44%, Tory on 23%, Reform.
Yes.
13%, so only 10% behind.
Yes.
So it's a 10% gap between them. Go back to the start of December, the Tories are on 25, Reform on 8. So it's a 17% gap. It's just a few months, they've gone from 17% down to 10%.
It's because people are leaving the Tory party in droves, and where do you go? Well, if you want to go to the centre, you move towards Lib Dems or Labour, and if you still feel that the Tories are not suiting you on the right, then you go to Reform. It's essentially, Tories are out of favour in every possible way.
So is Reform, so we're talking about populism, is that because Reform are seen as being the populist alternative, and people feel as though that if they go there, they're going to have a better answer to the ailments of society, and life is going to be better with them.
Well, I think that they promise what they promise, because that's how populism works. You give people, tell people there are crises, and you offer them solutions, and you say things are going to get better, and you
don't necessarily have to deliver it, of course.
No.
If you're a populist government who never gets in, you can promise anything you want. Really, you can say they are so bad at this. Get us in charge and we'll solve the problem.
But it's a real phenomenon at the moment, because you've got them in the UK, obviously. We talked about that. They're coming into power in different parts of Europe, potentially, certainly maybe this year in the United States again. They were in power in Brazil. They were in power in the Philippines. I think, it is more of a trend than anything else, and something that tells us something about the direction of modern politics.
And we had, so we've seen the rise of populism in the media as well. So we've seen channels like GB News and UK TV coming. Not UK TV. What's the other one? Talk TV. Sorry, I shouldn't have said. I went for Talk Radio for a very short period of time. But GB News.
It's riding the same thing. And Fox News, of course, in the States. So it's a whole ecosystem, if you like, that's out there. So, what's the significance of it, and what does it mean for our politics? Joining us now, I'm very pleased to say, is Andy Knott, senior lecturer at Brighton University.
So, Andy, first of all, why is in your mind, what is populism, and why is it not more popular? It is popular, but you would have thought if it was populism, everybody would be in support of it, and yet populism seems to be quite divisive. So, why is that?
I really like the way in which you framed that open question, actually. Let me say a few things about that. Certain people actually use the term popularism, which is sliding those two ideas together. That isn't a concept that's been picked up within the academy, for instance, which is where I inhabit. But in terms of what is populism, there is what myself and others have called an emerging consensus around the question, what is populism, which has been really heavily debated. And there are really kind of different understandings about what it is. And maybe we'll come to that in the course of this.
Well, give us the kind of working definition that you would use normally.
And let me also I'll give you what the Oxford Dictionary says.
Go on, then.
Because it says it's a political approach that strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel that their concerns are disregarded by established and elite groups. That comes from the rather elite Oxford Dictionary. So I don't know. Is that a good one?
I think it is, for what it's worth. I mean, the way in which I put it is populism is an antagonistic form of politics that pits the people against an adversary. And what that's actually enabling is an awful lot of scope for very, very different forms of politics. I think populism has to have all those different features. Now, the adversary would fit in with what you've kind of indicated there, the establishment elites. If you have the Latin American history of populism is one of the most pronounced. So that goes back to Peronism in the middle of the 20th century.
In Argentina.
Yep. And the adversary there is the oligarchia, or the oligarchy, effectively. And as to your question about why isn't populism very popular, well, that's a little bit of a double-edged sword, actually, because effectively, populism is popular, which is why we're talking about it.
I think my question is, why is it not more popular? You would have thought if it was, you know, if it was populist in its approach, then everybody would want to be part of it. Everyone would be supporting it. And yet the...
Yeah, here, let me put this out there. The kind of circles that you operate in and the kind of circles that I operate in makes the talk about populism something that's very, very unpopular. So the way in which the term is used is... normally a derogatory term. It's to try and suggest that politician X is a bad politician, effectively.
Except for those people who support it, as you say, it's...
But they wouldn't call themselves populist. That's the thing, I think. I mean, what Andy's saying, I mean, so Reform, I guess, would not, for example, in this country, call themselves populist. The fact they bristle at the idea of being far right as well. We can talk about right and left in a moment. Mm. But they won't describe themselves as populist.
I think that's one of the key things to highlight. The term is bestowed upon somebody else. So, for instance, Donald Trump is a populist, Nigel Farage is a populist, and I agree with both of those. This one, I'm kind of a little bit more on the fence on, despite the fact that it's kind of quite widely accepted. Boris Johnson is a populist.
So what's the different? How are you grouping all of those people together? What is the shared characteristic amongst all of them? I guess it gets back to your definition that they are there.
Here I might go into the kind of some of the different understandings that have been proposed for populism, and the most predominant one is to claim that populism is an ideology. And that's associated with a figure called Casmuda. What that effectively means is that there is some readily identifiable content, policy content, for instance, that you would want to align with somebody that you're claiming to be a populist. I reject that understanding, and I will use several different alternative ways of characterizing populism. It's a style of doing politics. It's a form of politics. It's a logic of the political. It's a discourse of politics.
And isn't it actually really a common... I mean, we're talking about it as a modern phenomenon, perhaps, but actually isn't all politics at root populist? You know, if you think of the rise of the Labour Party at the beginning of the 20th century, it was against, in your terms, the ruling classes, the bosses. If you think of conservatism rising, it was against certain forms of change which they felt were something to do with the establishment. You know, you can trace every political movement back to a form of populism, can't you?
What you're saying there, effectively, Roger, is that politics is necessarily antagonistic. And it just kind of take those antagonisms just take different forms. Well, let me say a couple of things on that. The first one relates to your claim about it going back earlier from modern politics. I would probably reject that, and that there are earlier kind of proto-populist forms of politics, which you might call plebeian politics. So you can trace that back to the period of the Roman Republic when the tribune of the plebs emerged in order to...
The plebs being the common people.
Yeah, in order for the common people to assert themselves against the Senate and the oligarchical kind of regimes. But two things in terms of what you were saying about it. All politics is populist politics, or at root populist politics. Firstly, populism doesn't have a monopoly on antagonism or antagonistic politics. And secondly, populism doesn't have a monopoly on the people. In terms of antagonistic politics, there are many forms of what I'd call non-populist antagonistic politics, such as the suffragettes, for instance.
But so you wouldn't say the suffragettes were populist, definitely?
No, I wouldn't, because it was never conducted in the name of the people. it was always conducted over a very specific cause, which was getting women the vote. You know, they're kind of tactics that they pursued in order to get the vote. I suppose you would quite legitimately characterize as kind of anti-establishment type politics. I would also call many socialistic or politics that have been done in the name of the working class, or if you'd rather call it the proletariat, those are antagonistic forms of politics, but they're not populistic form of politics.
So Marxism, Marxist revolution would not be a populist thing in your terms?
No.
But why? Because we always think of populism as being to the right. So why is that? Well, if it's antagonistic, you would have thought that you are, you know, fighting against the establishment.
Yeah.
You would have thought there'd be a natural leaning to the left, if anything.
Well, again, I'm going to say there's two things that I can say on that, effectively. If you go back into history, most of what have been identified as earlier episodes of populism, they are of the left, effectively. So I've mentioned Peronism. That was the first populism in power, and that was largely a leftist project. There's some ambiguity there, but if you go back to one of the earliest kind of identified forms of populism, where in fact the term populism was first used, and that was the People's Party of the United States, which I think still is the largest third party since the Democrats and the Republicans established their
geography. Just take us into that, because I don't think many people would know about the Popular Party. When was that, and how did it work?
It was in the 1890s, and they kind of emerged as a significant force almost overnight, and there was enormous passion about them. They kind of burnt and faded quite quickly. And I think that probably says something about populism, effectively, is it isn't really a kind of permanent form of politics. It tends to be quite temporary. Although what we're experiencing, certainly in the UK, but I think you can go, you know, more broadly than that, the wider global north or west, if you prefer to use those terms, they've all been having experiences with populism over the last decade or two. Here I'm probably going to go somewhat technical. I think one of the key things about understanding not only populism but also politics more generally is to engage with the notion of hegemony and to try and establish what is what I'd call a hegemonic formation.
Okay, you better explain what you mean by that, because that's...
I am. And in fact, I'm going to illustrate it through a particular example that I suspect we're all familiar with. You know, it's certainly carried the three of us through our lifetimes. Round about 1979, with Margaret Thatcher's...
rise to power.
Rise to power. Similarly with Reagan in the United States, you had a hegemonic formation that I call neoliberal financialized globalization. And that was on the march thereafter. And everything was largely conducted within those terms that set the agenda of political debate. So I don't think that the Blair Project was a substantial departure from neoliberal financialization.
So when in 1997 onwards, you would say it was a kind of continuation of something that had come into play from that period in the 80s.
Yeah.
So what's the connection then? So from neoliberalism to this populism. So is populism a revolt against neoliberalism? Is that what you're saying?
I'm actually using the term neoliberal financialized globalization. So what I think the populist explosion has been about is effectively each of the three prongs of those have come under challenge, but from different actors, often from populist actors. And certainly within the UK, for instance, I think it's the globalization that has been most prominently targeted, and that might go to explain Brexit, for example, but also the kind of re-emergence of nationalism that we see across the world. Now, one of the key things I think to do is that you need to differentiate between populism and nationalism. And what certainly happened with Brexit, I think, was that those two became conjoined. But I think you do need to analytically distinguish between those two. Because, for instance, I would also call Putin a nationalist, maybe even a fascist as well.
But not a populist?
But not a populist, yeah.
Mm. It's interesting. So, I mean, just
because populism is, as you say, it's antagonistic. It's hard to be a populist if you're already in power, isn't it? I mean, you've almost got to be out of power to be a populist, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's quite interesting. It is hard to be a populist, but what you can do, and I think Erdogan's done this in Turkey, for instance, is to claim that there's a kind of deep, settled establishment, or what Trump would call the deep state.
Yes, yeah. Drain the swamp. And of
that's
course,
right. So I'll stay, really in power, stay in power because I'm here helping to fight against the other powers that are stopping me being in power. That's the people who are fighting against democracy and all that sort of stuff.
So in those circumstances, then, so what you're saying is you've got the people who are, as I say, in power, but sort of claiming that they are fighting the power. But overall, you see as a general thing, I'm really interested in this, the kind of structures that were put in place in the West, certainly from the 80s onwards, you're seeing the populism really, whether it's in this country or the United States, perhaps, or even in somewhere like Brazil and Bolsonaro, is a pushback against globalization, the economic norms that were put in place at that point.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key components. One thing that I haven't mentioned is that populism thrives within a crisis. And I think that what I call hegemonic formation of neoliberal financialized globalization went into crisis in 2008, effectively.
Mm. It wasn't because of the financial crisis we're talking about, the big crash.
Yeah. Right. And so you get the rich who, you know, aren't suffering and the poor are suffering a great deal. So it becomes the widening rich-poor gap, really, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, that has happened beforehand, but what becomes difficult is for the proponents of that form of politics to say there is no alternative, for instance, and the medicine is working, etc., etc. More and more of the public, of the people, actually depart from that and start searching for alternative frames of approaching politics. And I think we're still very much in that scenario at the moment.
I'm seeing a very strong historical parallel here, Andy, if I just sort of draw it, because I mean, which is with the interwar years in the 20s and 30s, because a lot of people explain what happened then as a financial crisis leading to populism of the kind you're talking about that produced fascism and Nazism, amongst other things. Is that the right parallel?
Sort of, I would say. What certainly happened in terms of 1929 and the Wall Street crash and the ensuing financial crisis, which then led on to things like austerity, and you can see the parallels with the more recent age there, is there was a kind of delayed reaction to 1929, which in the UK came in 1945. It came much earlier in the United States with a New Deal, actually, and they managed to resolve it. And in fact, the New Deal was informed to a considerable extent by some of the policies that the People's Party of the 1890s that I've already mentioned were advocating. But I'm not so sure that you could characterise the rise of the Nazis, for instance, as being an episode of populism. I think there was certainly a crisis at that particular historical moment, but I don't think there was too much populism going on there, by which I mean precisely about pitting the people against an adversary, an elite, the establishment during that particular point of time. I think it was done far more precisely by the Nazis and by slightly different ways.
So that adversary, you reckon, is important? Because, I mean, because those ways would be, you know, that you had a charismatic leader, that's a shame to say, who was there at a time when people were suffering, who was basically saying, well, you know, vote me in and I will lead you to a better world, to a better Germany.
And I will defeat the forces that have kept you there, the dark state, the swamp, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and those, you know, nasty migrants and Jewish people. And he won people over on that. So, but there wasn't a political adversary as such, which you're saying is the important component.
Yeah. I'm not so sure that there was such a thing as a kind of an establishment. The core thing that Hitler was saying was that things were failing and I can step in and make things better.
So where we are now, I mean, I'm just wondering whether Rishi Sunak is almost becoming a populist leader, even though he's in power, because he's trying to push. If we think that without that adversary component, I mean, it's pushing people's buttons, isn't it? I mean, Roger's not done this, but I've done a bit of talkback radio in Australia. Mm. So, and it's, you know, there's a formula there. You just, what is it that people are feeling? What's the hurt? And who can you blame? And so you talk about immigration, you talk about the liberal elite, you probably talk about trans people, you talk about woke, obviously woke people, you know, they're changing the values of society, and obviously cyclists, and now people who drive electric cars, all the ills of society, that'll get the phones ringing, sadly, and politics is doing exactly the same things. What is it that people are upset about? Because either they haven't got it themselves, or they feel as though they're trapped in their position by somebody else who is either doing better or is stopping them getting ahead. I mean, that's the key, you know, they're the buttons you want to press, aren't they? As a politician, you just come and say, well, okay, Johnny Foreigner's taking your jobs away, vote for Brexit, we'll stop them coming in. This government hasn't stopped them coming in, vote for us, we'll do it. It's sort of like failure to tackle those things, which is the reason why the Reform Party is taking so many votes away from the Tories at the moment.
What you've just listed there sounds very familiar if you've been paying attention to politics over the last decade or so. One of the things about the Conservative Party and populism that I suppose I depart from others is it becomes quite difficult for them, for instance, to claim that they're acting in the name of the people against the establishment, because the Conservative Party tend to want to be viewed as upholding the establishment, as upholding continuity with the past.
Provide that strong and stable government, isn't it?
Deliver that kind of, deliver that continuity with the past. Mm. So one of the things about Boris Johnson, if you actually have a look at the way in which he framed his language, he never actually said that I'm going to mobilise the people against the establishment. For instance, when he prorogued Parliament, it certainly was the people versus Parliament, but it wasn't a kind of sustained attack in the way in which Nigel Farage has done that. And the elites that Farage targeted was obviously the EU, but it wasn't just the EU, it was the political class in Westminster who were facilitating the EU's expansionary project.
And it doesn't matter on your background, you can be anti-elite while being elite yourself, it seems. I mean, because Farage, you know, he was a stockbroker who went to a private school. Yeah, same with Trump. Obviously, Richard Tice actually comes from Farnham. His mother trained horses, and you know, grandfather was a property developer. He went to a private school. I mean, these are all what we call the elite who are there, you know, on the people.
But they're using the arguments in the way that they need to. But one interesting thing on this, Andy, is how far does it go? You talked about previous moments in the past where this has been a surge of populism in one form or another. Mm-hmm. With this current one, it has seemed to have been going on for a while. We can date it back here, I suppose, to the Brexit campaign, perhaps. Do you see this as a major systemic change coming down the line? Perhaps a change of us talking about right and left-wing politics in the way we have, or the Labour-Conservative split as before? Or is it just something that comes and goes, a bit like the People's Party you were talking about in the US?
Yeah, I mean, there is a little bit of a debate going on about that as to whether we've entered into what many people call permapopulism. We're in the kind of situation in which politics flourishes, populist forms of politics flourishes, or whether it's kind of cyclical, which I was kind of referring to in terms of the People's Party kind of emerging, having quite a profound impact for a limited period of time, and then going away quite quickly.
Which do you think it is? Do you think it? What's your sense?
I find it quite difficult to actually analyse, actually, and to come down to a kind of firm position on that particular debate, because one of the reasons why I'm saying that populism doesn't have a monopoly on the concept of the people or an appeal to the people is there are different appeals to the people. The people is the most appealed to political subject, and a very different non-populistic understanding of the people is that the people and the establishment or the elite are as one with one another, and the elite or the establishment works alongside and on behalf of the people. And that's broadly the conservative position, as far as I can understand it. The other thing to mention is populism and crisis, and maybe to go a little bit deeper into this. And I was having a look at some of your earlier episodes from this year, and let me list a few of the titles of your episode just within 2024. Democracy in Crisis, The Red Sea Crisis, Great Britain, Can It Be Mended, Generation Game, Why Boomers Are Cheating.
You're saying we're a populist podcast, is that what you're saying?
I'm not actually saying that, but what I am saying is that we are in quite severe crisis and have been. It's not an acute crisis, it's chronic. That's where we are. And I suppose my answer to your earlier question would be effectively, so long as this sense of crisis continues, then I think populism will continue.
Right. So, it's on that then. So there's a need for change, clearly, isn't there? And so if you're a government like the Tory Party and even the Labour Party as well, saying we're strong and stable, you're in safe hands, people will say, well, we don't want to be in safe hands because we've been in that for a long time and it's not good at getting us anywhere.
We want radical
change.
We're
in perpetual crisis. We need change, exactly. So they're stepping in. Any party that, whether it's populist or whatever, anybody who says, well, we are for the people and we're going to drive change and we are the adversary to the incumbent government as well, which is basically what you've been describing. So it's not really a surprise, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, I'm going to make a prediction here, which I'm doing it off the back of John Curtis, who knows about this stuff.
A famous John Curtis sophologist,
the academic that's most familiar with opinion polling and interpreting opinion polling. He said that there's a 99% chance that a Starmer government will materialise by the end of the year. He also said that he'd be surprised if the Conservatives get as much as 150 seats in the next parliament. So I think, effectively, if we're talking about UK politics in the kind of short to midterm, we need to focus on what Starmer does once in power. And that's an open question as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it seems like, you know, because he's going on the safe ground, unless he sort of reverts back to what he promised when he was vying for leadership of the Labour Party. I mean, he's completely moderated his stance. It seems like it'll be almost like a continuation of where we are now. So,
yeah, because they're terrified of not making it over the line.
So the populist parties will continue. I mean, Reform, you know, might actually overtake the Tories in that case, because they'll be seen as being the adversary, not against the Tories now, but against the against Labour.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't write off the Conservative Party in a hurry. They've been with us for 300 years and been in power for about two-thirds of that time. So they're extremely resilient. I suspect they'll have a difficult next parliament, but they'll come back. They always do. And I think Reform is a little bit of a distraction, effectively, at the moment.
But on the other hand, we may be in a position at the end of this year where in the United States there is a very powerful populist administration, rather more extreme in many ways, I guess, than what we see here, even potentially from Reform.
Yeah.
Won't that set the political temperature and climate quite dramatically globally.
Yeah, I mean, that will shift things an awful lot. I would again claim that it would probably shift things far more in the direction of nationalism. So if we look at two current international geopolitical events, it probably will be a sucker for Israel, for instance, and it will be a sucker for Putin and against Ukraine, if that materializes. Those are the two immediate factors. You might see further kind of cranking up of hostilities with China, which he certainly saw in his first term.
So does that fall into populism? Because that's sort of like...
That's more nationalism. Well, yeah.
I'm looking back at the populist party that we were talking about in the 1890s. Some of their policies, they wanted to ban foreign land ownership. So we're
this
there,
is the one in the United States.
In the United States. So there, again, it's sort of like a more nationalistic approach. We don't want foreign involvement in our land. State control of the railways, you know, which is what Labour Party, you know, most people would like the Labour Party actually to do, seeing as they're not working currently. And shortened work days, which, you know, so they're actually, you know, what you'd assume would be sort of more Labour Party rather than other equivalent.
But those aren't Trump policies. Those aren't policies of an incoming Trump administration.
No.
He's not in the same ballpark.
Yeah, to try and make the point that back in those days, it was very much, you know, for the people and what you'd consider being left-leaning policies, yeah, by and large.
Definitely. But something else that you've raised earlier that I'll come back to, I think most people's understanding of the left and the right need to change from what they are. And in fact, I'm due to be writing a book on this as well. But it's a long way off. I've got too many
Because you've got to get your head around it.
I was going to say, you may have a lot to cram in one way or another.
Yeah. I think the predominant understanding of left and right, if you have a look at the political compass, I don't know if you two have done the political compass.
Personally, no. But we may get to that point.
What that presents is a grid, effectively. And on the horizontal axis, there is the contrast between the right and the left. And helpfully, they call it the economic. So what they effectively want the right to be is free market, you know, and no or very minimal state. What the left is basically that the state conducts everything within the economy, according to that understanding. Now, on the vertical grid, there's authoritarianism versus libertarianism. And I suppose, kind of put simply, I claim that the right and the left have kind of merged those two features into one another far more, such that it becomes far more difficult to identify the right and the left through either of those two axes.
And those axes are complicated further by the fact that economists, for example, wouldn't agree what a free market is either,
yeah, yeah,
and how it operates. So there's so much complexity in all of that.
Exactly. And the idea of there being a completely free market with no state is bonkers, because you need the state in order to ensure that the contracts that operate within the market are enforced. So even the kind of greatest free market theorist, which is a guy called Robert Nozick, recognized the necessity of a minimal state. He thought it was a kind of quite harsh, hard state, but it was a very, very small state.
You need to generate money somehow,
yeah,
as well. If you've just got the same amount of money floating around without expanding, that free market's going to dry up pretty quickly as well. But anyway, we're going off at a tangent.
We are rather, and we need to draw this discussion to a close, I'm afraid, Andy. But essentially, what I'm drawing from this is a sense that you think it is. There may be a moment of more profound change happening. This may be more than purely a cyclical move towards populism surging in the West. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, all I can say is that the core principles associated with what I'd call the prior hegemonic formation, which I've called neoliberal financialized globalization, no longer work. And there was a prior transformation from the what I call the post-war consensus or Keynesianism or social democracy that basically existed from round about 1945 or from the early 1930s in the United States up until the 1970s, when there was this shift into the new framework. And I think that there are multiple crises. There's an economic crisis, which is, I'll render it as an inequality crisis. There's environmental crises. There's also what I call a representational crisis, which is a slow burn in effect, in which it's not only about politicians being less trusted, which has been going on since the 1960s, but also a representational crisis for the media, effectively, which, I mean, you two have both operated in the media. It used to be a kind of one-to-many type delivery, whereas now we have podcasts such as The Y Curve, for instance. So there's kind of new...
One to less than many relationship there. Yeah,
it's interesting, as you say, a series of crises pushing it into a very different way of dealing with things. And
whether they can be resolved and how they can be resolved is a kind of interesting question. But I suppose my core claim is that they can't, through the kind of mechanisms that have been pursued from 1979 onwards.
And yet if the problems all started, if we started to have this crisis with the, you know, just from an economic point of view, the neoliberal approach to economics since the, you know, since the Thatcher mm-hmm. era, if that's part of the problem, and I think it, you know, personally, I think it is, the revolution is not going to come from the people who are challenging the government currently, because they are people who largely were Margaret Thatcher supporters, probably have read all Milton Friedman's books. Mm-hmm. They would be part of the problem.
Well, you're talking about within the UK, you're talking about reform there, are you?
Yeah.
Note again, I'm calling it neoliberal financialized globalization. And what reform are basically targeting is the globalization aspect via nationalism. But it's not the other crisis that I think we're going through at the moment is an identity crisis, which is coming from both sides. Effectively, the reformist right and certain wings of the Conservative Party are wanting to insist that we have a kind of settled, stable identity, which would be that we're British, for instance. Whereas you've got all sorts of different developments going on as a result of, for instance, the rise of LGBTQI+. And note that keeps on getting extended, for instance. But also,
I think you've added plus on the end. You don't need to add anything else. Like, we're running out of time now, but I think we are entering into a whole other discussion.
The identity crisis is a fair point. Is part of the issue in all this.
If we're British, we would be all standing hanging on at the end of the bar with a beer in our hand, like Nigel Farage.
The things can't get more populists lean on in order to get to where they are. But Andy, thank you very much. That's a great survey of why we are where we are in terms of populism, and interesting thoughts that it may be. As you say, something rather more fundamental than cyclical, and how we will deal with it would be interesting.
We'll see how it unfolds.
But we will keep on doing the crises here on YK.
Yeah, and we'll keep doing that with that one to several media model that you talk about. Good to talk, Andy. We'll catch you soon again, hopefully.
Thanks very much.
Great, thank you.
And interesting, you're saying that Putin is not a populist.
Yes.
And Hitler wasn't. I mean, let's put them both in the same sentence. I think we can safely do that now, can't we, these days?
Some would say.
But, I mean, you know, he wasn't a populist either. Well, and yet, you know, they're all about, well, how can we retain control by doing stuff that we think will make us more powerful?
By breaking the rules, fundamentally. Well, That's a big part of it, which, of course, populists are much more able to do, or indeed nationalists in this case. But you mentioned Hitler, you mentioned Putin. Some people, well, particularly the Polish government, Donald Tusk, the Polish Prime Minister, has been talking about this being 1939. He says that what's happening in Ukraine is getting to the point where there could be a collapse. If there is, and the Russians move in very fast. He says this is the point at which the growth and expansion that Putin wants to do will go further.
Yeah.
And everybody needs to be very, very scared about this.
And how is the United Nations positioned in all of this as well? So if Donald Trump comes along and weakens the power of the United Nations...
Well, NATO is the problem, because NATO is there, but will NATO be fully supported by the
US? I'm in NATO, so I was meant to say so. And that's why everyone getting together to say, well, okay, perhaps we need to fund more because we might have to do without the United States.
We might. It's a big crisis, and I mean, it's been a big crisis, and we covered it here on the Y Curve, but there's a feeling that we are at a moment of potentially very dangerous change.
Yeah, it feels that way, doesn't it?
And that's what we're going to look at next week here on
the Y Curve. Join us for that. Thanks for joining us today. Have a great week.
Thanks, bye.
The Y Curve.